It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll hear from a UW researcher who's taking a closer look at the August storms that caused flooding around the state and at the risks facing communities in the future. First, it's time for a weekly look at the big stories in national politics. Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, is resigning her post at the end of the year. A top Republican is introducing a bill that would fund a Mexican border wall. And both major parties are assessing their political fortunes in the wake of the highly partisan confirmation process for Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. Our question of the week for you is, do you think the Kavanaugh confirmation will affect voting next month? If you're a Republican, are you more excited to vote after seeing how things played out? Or if you lean Democratic, do you feel more motivated? If you're neither, none of the above, is this going to affect your vote? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Scott Wong is a senior staff writer for The Hill, where he covers House Republicans. Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, UN Ambassador Nikki Haley announced this week that she'll be resigning her position there at the end of the year. Ordinarily, you know, a two-year term for UN Ambassador, this wouldn't be huge news, but what do we know about the story?
That's right. In fact, she apparently told Trump at the start of her tenure that she probably would only stay for a couple of years, and it's not unusual for people to move on. I think what's unusual here is that the timing of her announcement, it came on the heels of a huge Republican victory. The Senate was able to confirm Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court, and so I think a lot of Republicans on Capitol Hill and elsewhere in town were a little baffled about why Nikki Haley chose to make this announcement on that particular day. It sort of stepped on the message of Republicans as they were celebrating their victory on Kavanaugh.
Now let's look a little bit at Nikki Haley. She's coming out of the Trump administration looking pretty good. A lot of people in other positions were effectively fired. They were seen in some ways as tainted, either for Republicans in general or for pro-Trump Republicans in particular. She is coming out pretty good, it looks like.
Yeah, if you look at other cabinet secretaries who resigned in scandal, Tom Price at HHS or Scott Pruitt at the EPA, they were not given any face time with the president as they made their exit from the White House. The same goes for other chiefs of staff and other communications directors. Nikki Haley got pretty good treatment from President Trump. There was a sit-down at the White House between the two of them that was televised. They both had kind words for each other. And I think that's significant because a lot of people have been talking about Nikki Haley because she was sort of a Trump critic back in 2016 before her appointment to the UN. A lot of people saw her as a possible challenger to President Trump in the GOP primary, but she put all of those rumors to rest. She said in 2020 she will not be running for any other office and she will be in the private sector supporting the president's reelection.
Haley made a point also to look at the direction that foreign policy has gone under the Trump administration, her a big part of the team. Here's a bit of what she had to say.
Look at what has happened in 2 years with the United States on foreign policy. Now the United States is respected. Countries may not like what we do, but they respect what we do. They know that if we say we're going to do something, we follow it through, and the president proved that.
And she has been seen in foreign policy. People thought she might be in some ways a moderating influence, but she's definitely been part of a hawkish team on issues, including Iran and others, more hawkish on Russia maybe than the Trump administration. What happens to foreign policy without her on board now?
Well, that's a good question. She was a very moderating force, she was seen as somebody who was respected, who had relationships throughout Washington and on Capitol Hill. And so it's going to be interesting to see, who she replaced with. There's a lot of names floating around right now. Former Deputy National Security Advisor Dina Powell seems to be the front runner. She's somebody that Haley, in fact, has advocated for. Trump has said some kind words about Dina Powell, that she was very well qualified. But there's a number of others who could step into the role as well. Ambassador to Germany, Rick Grenell, is somebody whose name has been tossed around. Even Bob Corker, the retiring senator from Tennessee, although I think that's a little far-fetched given that he and Trump clashed last summer over a number of issues.
We're talking to Scott Wong from The Hill, looking at some of the top stories in national politics this week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Our question for you, how do you see the Kavanaugh confirmation process affecting voting in November, if at all? Let's bring on a caller. Lester is with us in Madison. Lester, hi.
Hi. So I think that her timing was actually perfect. By resigning now, by resigning at the time that they're having this huge bump from the Kavanaugh confirmation, there's not so much attention paid to her resignation as there would have been at another time when the tumult had kind of calmed down there.
Interesting point, Lester. Thanks a lot for calling in. Yeah, the Kavanaugh story over the last a couple of weeks, Scott, has taken a lot of the air out of the room for other stories that might have gotten more attention. This might be another one. This might be a time when we pay less attention. Not that there's been a lot of quiet moments in the last 2 years, but maybe this is a particular one where we're not going to pay as much attention.
No, I think your caller's right, and it sort of speaks to the disconnect between Washington and the rest of the country, perhaps, because in Washington, the Nikki Haley story was a huge story. We all know her as a political figure, a significant political figure in the Trump cabinet, and maybe that story is not resonating as much outside of the Beltway. Maybe the Kavanaugh story is still what voters are thinking about, foremost on their minds.
Let's turn now to the Brett Kavanaugh story. He is a sitting Supreme Court justice now, and both parties trying to make the case that the tumultuous confirmation process is going to help their cause. Here's House Speaker Paul Ryan sounding pretty optimistic talking to the National Press Club.
The Republican base is very much activated as a result of this. I think the Democrat base was already there. So I think if anything, in the wash of it all, this is definitely, I could just see it just from traveling around the country in the last few days, traveling around Wisconsin. The Republican base is definitely animated after this.
There's polling out there, Scott. It may be tough ultimately to sort this out. What are you looking at as we try to figure out if one party or the other gets more of an election boost out of this?
Yeah, you know, both parties are trying to spin this in their direction. For Republicans, they're saying Speaker Ryan and Mitch McConnell are saying that this issue has engaged Republican voters who sort of had been complacent given that Republicans control both houses of Congress and the White House. And now Kavanaugh has gotten them engaged and fired up for the election. Democrats are saying sort of the same thing, that because of the treatment of Christine Blasey Ford, because of the process and how Democrats believe that the nomination was sort of rammed through, they believe that Democrats are going to be even more fired up for the midterms. The polls are showing a bunch of different things, but there was an interesting Politico poll that came out today that showed that Democrats are more energized after the Kavanaugh hearings than Republicans, that 77% of Democrats said that they were very motivated to turn out and vote in the midterms, while only 68% of Republicans said that they were very motivated to turn out. So that was an interesting development today. Republicans are pointing to some older polls in the middle of those hearings that showed that Republicans were starting to get more engaged.
Let's bring on a caller on this. Lori joins us from Madison. Lori, hello.
Hello. I just want to agree with, I think that this has gotten the Democrats motivated, and they are going to be out on the polls more. Just the treatment and the way that it didn't seem to matter, just the straight party line on the vote was just outrageous.
Lori, thanks a lot for the call. And Scott, this is still a month out from Election Day. It may be that if there's an election next Tuesday, this might still be firing people up. Is it possible we're going to see three or four other stories that are going to fire up or depress one side or the other between now and the actual election day?
I mean, I think that's a very good point, given that this news cycle is churning so quickly from issue to issue. You know, remember just a month ago when the Bob Woodward book was huge news, or the New York Times editorial from the anonymous Trump official saying that there was all sorts of chaos and tumult in the White House. Those stories seem like a distant memory at this point. And given today's news, where we have a major hurricane battering the South and Florida, a lot of people are going to be displaced from this hurricane. It'll be interesting to see how the Trump administration and FEMA addresses this natural disaster, as well as the huge plunge in the stock market today. So there's news stories that are happening all the time. 30 days is a long time till Election Day.
Scott Wong is with us, senior staff writer at The Hill. We're talking about some of the week's top news in national politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Our question for you, do you think one party or the other gets a bigger boost of energy after this long and difficult confirmation process for Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court? If you're on one side or the other already, what do you see happening? If you see yourself in the middle, does the confirmation process move you one way or the other, or it's not at the top of your list and why you're going to vote? You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill. We're talking about some of the week's biggest news in national politics. Scott, picking up on where we left off, looking at the election in the aftermath of the Kavanaugh confirmation process, a lot of protests, obviously, in the Senate, in and around the Senate, the Supreme Court, too. Republicans thinking that could help them. A pretty consistent talking point from the president, from U.S. senators and others. Angry mobs of Democrats. Can you talk about what case they're making there?
Well, that's right. I mean, the president, Mitch McConnell, other Republicans in the House and Senate, up and down the ballot, are calling out those protesters as an angry left-wing mob. You know, they're basically warning or trying to instill fear in voters that handing power to Democrats this November will be handing power to a dangerous, out-of-control mob of anarchists. And so it has been a common talking point from Republicans, from conservatives. Republicans are hoping that this not only stokes some fear for Republican voters, but drives them to the polls. And, you know, yes, there has been some violence in politics over the past 18 months. You know, we remember the 2017 congressional baseball shooting that left Steve Scalise severely injured. Rand Paul's neighbor attacked him. But those, I think the difference there was those acts of violence were not carried out by Democratic activists. For the most part, you know, as far as we could tell, all of the protests at the Kavanaugh hearings over the past couple of weeks, though they resulted in hundreds of arrests, they were, for the most part, peaceful. And so I think that's important to point out.
And in the past, Democrats have hoped that angry Tea Party rallies going back to 2010 might rally Democrats. They hope that angry President Trump rallies with a chance of lock her up against Hillary Clinton, now Senator Dianne Feinstein, would rally voters on the Democratic side. In both cases, that didn't pan out that way.
Yeah, I mean, if you think back to 2010, Democrats were warning against the Tea Party protesters that descended on these Democratic healthcare town halls and on Washington, D.C., where tens of thousands turned out for these Tea Party protests. Democrats warned that, you know, that this would be handing over power to the angry mobs. Well, in fact, 2010 was the year that the Tea Party wave washed over Washington and handed the House of Representatives to Republicans. And so, you know, it seems like there are a number of parallels between 2010 and 2018, although the parties sort of have reversed themselves. And so it'll be interesting to see if this is, in fact, sort of a mirror image for Democrats of the 2010 election.
Let's go back to our callers. Robert is with us in Appleton. Robert, hi.
Yeah, you need to make a distinction between the House and the Senate races. The Democrats, because of candidate selection and a variety of different demographic factors, are very well positioned to take over the House. The districts, remember, in a state, you run for the whole state. In the House districts, the Democrats have got a number of different states, such as Pennsylvania with new districts, New Jersey. They're going to take the House, there's no question. This is going to hurt the Democrats in places like North Dakota, Missouri. Manchin is not going to help himself with conservatives, but he may very well have lost, progressive votes. The key thing is that you just give Trump a month to, be a narcissist, to tell, eight lies a day, to make himself the center of the story. And I think by the time the election is done, it's going to be a referendum on Trump.
Robert, thanks a lot for the call. A lot there, Scott. He's definitely right about the Senate versus House distinction. Democrats defending a lot more seats in the Senate in places less favorable to them. One possible outcome could be, among many, big wins for Democrats in the House, not so great for Democrats in the Senate, Scott.
I mean, I think that's the most likely option at this point. There's tremendous energy, obviously, on the Democratic side. Following these Kavanaugh hearings, where a lot of women voters felt alienated, felt very angry at the treatment of some of the Kavanaugh accusers and didn't like the process itself, they're going to be turning up at the polls, and where that's going to make the most impact is in some of these suburban, well-educated, affluent districts that are now controlled by Republicans. That blue wave could sweep over a lot of those districts and flip the House of Representatives. Obviously, what the caller was talking about in about the Senate was that Democrats are defending a lot more seats in the Senate, and especially those in red states like Joe Manchin in West Virginia and Claire McCaskill in Missouri. And so if you have more engagement on the Republican side as a result of Kavanaugh, that's going to help Republicans perhaps pick up one or two seats and be able to preserve that Republican majority in the Senate.
Thanks for the call. Time for one more caller before we cover a couple more issues. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi. I'd gladly settle for Donald Trump if he only told eight lies a day. It's like eight lies of a story, but that's a separate issue. I would say, to answer your question, that traditionally I would have said yes, it does make a difference when you have a contentious hearing like the Kavanaugh hearing. I'm thinking back to, like, Clarence Thomas. One party got a boost, one party kind of took a hit from it. But nowadays, with what's going on, literally today we've had the stock market drop over 800 points. We had, a hurricane come ashore. We have a UN representative resign. I mean, it's like that's three major things, and the human mind can only focus on three or four major things in the, at any given time. And most people have stuff in their personal life, so it's like, the stories come in like machine gun fire, and you're trying to, focus in on one or two bullets whipping past you. I don't think it's going to happen.
Marcus, thanks a lot for the call. Touching, Scott, on what we were talking about earlier, where one story gets crowded out by the next story really quickly these days.
Well, that's right. And I think, one other way to think about that is that people are starting to receive their absentee ballots, their early ballots. And so if people know which way they're going to vote, they're going to be sending back those ballots based on today's news stories and how they feel today. I think the undecideds will perhaps hold on and wait till Election Day to vote. But there are votes being cast each day as we march to November 6th.
I want to touch on a couple more stories before we're done, Scott. Rod Rosenstein, Deputy Attorney General, a couple weeks ago, we all heard that he was resigning, was being fired, and that he was refusing to resign so that Trump would have to fire him. Now he's still in the job, meeting with President Trump, and supposed to meet with some Republicans in the House. So what's going on with that?
Well, he was supposed to appear before House Republicans earlier today. That meeting was postponed, but earlier this week, Rosenstein flew to Florida on Air Force One with President Trump. He appeared again at the White House today at a bill signing with the president for legislation on pharmaceuticals. I think this is an attempt for Trump to sort of bring Rosenstein a little bit closer. It's sort of that philosophy of keep your friends close and your enemies closer. Perhaps the president's trying to get inside the mind of Rosenstein as this Mueller investigation is proceeding. It's not entirely clear, but for now, Rosenstein's job appears safe, and Rosenstein does have some protection from the Republican leadership in Congress. Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan said they have full faith and trust in Rosenstein remaining in his position. It's some of the other conservative agitators that are trying to get Rosenstein fired and remove him from office.
And then Kevin McCarthy, one of those House Republican leaders, announced yesterday he's bringing out an immigration bill. Among other things, it would fully fund a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border. Give us the Cliff's Notes on this bill, Scott.
Yeah, sure. $23.4 billion for Trump's border wall. Of course, the Congress already punted the fight over funding until after the midterm elections. And so the next time the government will need to be funded will be in December. But what this means is that this issue of the border wall and immigration will be litigated on the campaign trail. It's just that they don't need to make any decisions until the lame duck session after the election. But obviously, immigration, always a hot-button issue, and it will continue to be in the lame duck session.
And there's a good chance, no matter what happens in the elections, the current Congress might decide this issue, not the 2019 Congress.
Immigration is probably not going to get resolved, anytime soon. And so it'll all depend on what happens in November and which parties are controlling the House and the Senate.
Scott, thanks as always for joining us.
Okay, thanks for having me.
That's Scott Wong, senior staff writer for The Hill, where he covers House Republicans, among other things. He was with us for our weekly look at the big stories in national politics. Heavy rain and flooding across the state this August led to the declaration of a statewide state of emergency. Now, researchers at UW-Madison are looking back at what happened in Dane County and trying to determine how often the region can expect similar storms and to learn lessons for communities around the state about how to deal with the risk of future flooding. Daniel Wright is an assistant professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at UW-Madison. He's the author of a recent piece on wiscontext.org titled, What Could Happen the Next Time Madison Gets Hit by Extreme Rainfall? Daniel, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, before we get into the specifics of your research and on flooding in the Madison area, you didn't use the word wake-up call in this piece on wiscontext, but it really seems like a wake-up call, not just for Madison, but for any community that might experience a risk of flooding.
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable way to put it. And honestly, from some of the analysis that I've done in the wake of these floods, it actually looks like Madison has been fairly lucky over the past several decades. And so what happened on August 20th shouldn't really be unprecedented by the standards of the climate in southern Wisconsin.
Well, let's take us into that storm. Madison, you focused on here, Madison and the local watershed got hit with a pretty big rain. It could have been way worse if the storm was just a little bit different in its path. Can you take us back to that day?
Yeah, certainly. So the real bulk of the rainfall was actually slightly west of the watershed. And when we say the watershed here, what we're talking about is the area, it's about 280 square miles, that drains into Lakes Mendota and Monona. And so actually the center of the rainstorm, those places where these 24-hour state rainfall records were set, you know, rainfalls on the order of 14 or 15 inches, that was actually west of the watershed. And so that water didn't actually end up getting into the chain of lakes here in Madison. And so what we did have over the watershed was about 4.5 inches of rainfall, which works out to more than 30,000 Olympic-sized swimming pools. But if that storm had occurred just 10 or 15 miles farther east, that could have been up to 8 inches of rainfall, so almost double the amount that we actually saw. And it's, I think, fair to assume that if that had actually taken place, the consequences in terms of flooding in Madison would have been much, much worse.
And let's look at how you do some of this research. We've talked about this a little bit on the show. Researchers, you and others, take storms and kind of transpose them to different geographical areas and say, okay, what would have happened if this storm hit here? And you're taking it to another step. How likely would that be?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So the basic notion here is that if a storm occurs somewhere near Madison, but not right over Madison exactly, then we can actually use that piece of information to tell us more about not only what potential outcomes might happen over the city and its watershed, but also how likely that sort of event might be. And so so for this particular project, we ended up looking at radar rainfall observations, so the same things that you see shown on the Weather Channel, and identifying major storms over the past about 15 years. And when you look at it from that perspective, the storm that we had here on August 20th was actually only about the fourth largest. And in fact, the storms that occurred farther west in the western part of the state about a week later were even a little bit larger than what we had here.
Talk about what a city like Madison and there are other communities that could do a similar thing can do with this kind of information.
Yeah, I think it's really useful for adding some context for what comes next. And so within Madison frankly, in communities around the country, there are a lot of conversations taking place now about what needs to be done to improve our infrastructure to stand up against events like this or even perhaps even larger events. And so what we can do is say, well, how likely is an event like the storm and flooding that we had in August here in Madison? And so the piece of software that I've developed and that my research group is continuing to push forward on gives us an estimate that says that a storm just like the one that we saw here on August 20th could occur on average once every 15 years or so in this area. Now there's some wiggle room on either side of that because of course the weather and climate is somewhat uncertain, but that estimate of about once every 15 years I think is a pretty good best guess. And so what that means is that's not something that is never going to happen again in our lifetimes. And so when we think about going forward, improving our stormwater management infrastructure, improving the management of our lakes, and improving our stormwater ordinances, so when, for example, developers want to do some sort of new construction, how they have to manage the runoff from that site, that sort of context can help to frame those sorts of discussions.
Talking to Daniel Wright from the UW-Madison Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering about a piece he wrote on WisContext about flooding, focusing on Madison, lessons for communities around the state, I think. Want to get into a couple maybe points of confusion for the public. We hear often thrown around phrases after a big weather event like, oh, this was a 100-year storm or a 1,000-year weather event or something like that, which should not, if I have this correctly, make us think like, oh, well, we got that out of the way. We've got another 1,000 years to the next one. That is not how it works.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. So so all that 100-year storm terminology means is that it's a storm that you would expect to happen on average once every 100 years. But anyone who's been to Las Vegas and played the odds on any sort of card game or anything else knows that just because the probability works one way doesn't mean that reality is going to turn out in exactly the way that you think. And so what that means is that you can have multiple 100-year storms or 100-year floods over relatively short periods of time. And on top of all of that, we have the issue of a warming climate, which basically adds more humidity to the atmosphere, which makes these storms more frequent, and when they do occur, larger. And so both in the upper Midwest and other parts of the country, there are very clear indications in our rainfall records that extreme rainfall events, particularly in the summertime, the types of events that we saw here and throughout Wisconsin in August are becoming more and more frequent.
To take you back to Vegas, it sounds like climate change is loading the dice a little bit. It doesn't mean we're going to have a flood every single year. It doesn't mean we can't go 5-10 years without a flood, but the odds of a flood any given year are higher.
That's absolutely right. And to rely only on our experiences from the past to make decisions going forward about how we're going to respond to these sorts of changes, in my opinion, is a big mistake, and we need to turn to, you know, cutting-edge climate science and advances in my field of hydrology and water resources engineering as well.
You mentioned storm runoff earlier, and reading your piece, it seems like a very different event if that 8 inches fell in a forest, in farmland, or on concrete, on a city with limited absorption capacity, I guess.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So, you know, it's clear that if you pave over an area, that area is no longer there, able to soak up heavy rainfall. And so in the case of Madison, you know, before the city of Madison was built up, this was all a wetland. And so now when you have heavy rainstorms, that water has to go somewhere. And so it's not able to soak into the soils. It's not, you know, filling up what used to be wetland areas. And so it has to go into the lakes, and the lake levels rise. In some cases, they can, and this is what we had here in Madison in August, the lake levels can rise so high that the stormwater sewers, which all are supposed to drain into the lakes, are no longer able to move the water the way they're supposed to, because there's nowhere for that water to go.
Is there a civic engineering solution to that? I've heard of things like permeable surfaces, concrete or asphalt, I can't remember what. Is that one possible solution?
Well, I think the right approach here is to look at all of the possible solutions, because I think particularly in the case of Madison, it's actually the case where there's not going to be one solution. There's not one magic bullet to this problem. You know, we've built up the area so much that we've sort of backed ourselves into a bit of a corner. Things like permeable pavements, rain gardens, rain barrels, green roofs, these are all so-called green infrastructure options that can perhaps move the needle a little bit. But on the other hand, I think that ultimately some bigger picture solutions are going to be necessary as well. So stricter stormwater management ordinances. We already have some of the strongest ordinances in the state, but there's fairly strong evidence that the ordinances even need to be a little bit stronger still to make sure that we're not making this problem worse in the future. And then also some reevaluation of how we manage the chain of lakes here. So Lake Mendota, for example, is that the level in that lake is able to be controlled by Tenney Dam. And so if the lake level had been lower prior to the August 20th storm, the impacts would have been less severe than they actually were.
As we wrap up, let's go back to the wake-up call idea. Are you hoping that leaders, both in Madison and in any community that might experience floods, will take this year's lessons and start trying to solve them now for next time?
That's certainly my hope, yes.
All right. We'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Daniel Ryder, the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at UW-Madison. You can read his piece about the increased likelihood of storms like we had in August online at wiscontext.org. And tomorrow after 4:30, we'll get an update on the current flooding and weather situation around the state. And we'll ask for your personal stories about flooding this year and how you, maybe your property, your community, are recovering. It seems inevitable that at some point in our lives, we'll experience some periods of loneliness. Maybe moving into a new city or leaving the familiarity of your parents' house. Maybe it's too much time at home with kids, or maybe as we grow older. But loneliness can be more complicated and more long-lasting than those isolated moments. By 2030, researchers are predicting loneliness to be an epidemic. It's been described by a former U.S. Surgeon General as one of the country's most pressing health risks. Think about a time in your life when you felt lonely, maybe alone in another country, at home with a new kid, alone, spending a holiday by yourself. Call 800-642-1234 with your story. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Kristen Radke is the art director and deputy publisher of The Believer. She wrote and illustrated the piece, What's the Loneliest You've Ever Been, for The Atlantic. And she's working on an essay collection called Seek You, Essays on American Loneliness. That's due out in a couple years. Kristen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
You wrote in The Atlantic that when you started talking about loneliness, that you're writing about it, a lot of people had loneliness stories.
Yeah, I'm writing this book about loneliness, as you mentioned, kind of, and I've been talking to a lot of scientists about loneliness and how loneliness affects our bodies, and I was really shocked by some of the research and studies they found. Like you mentioned a couple of the statistics, but scientists are finding that it, you know, if you're lonely for a prolonged period of time, if you're chronically lonely, it can actually start remapping the makeup of your cells. So I started just casually talking to friends about this, and I was amazed by how quickly friends or even strangers just started sharing their loneliest stories.
What kind of stories? Give us a sampling of the kinds of stories you heard.
A lot of them are about, as you mentioned, moments of transition. I think moments of transition can be really lonely, you know, after having a child or a move or after a breakup or divorce. But a lot of memories, too, that people recalled were from really long stretches of time. A lot of people talked about childhood. I know childhood can be really lonely because it can feel very confining. Or a city that they lived in for years in which they didn't have a lot of connection.
And how did people talk about this? Did this seem like a powerful memory to them?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's certainly a stigma about loneliness. I think we're afraid to talk about it and admit it because it seems to, like, admit some sort of fault within us. You know, I think we've worked to destigmatize depression, but I don't think we've done that with loneliness. So I think people are suddenly kind of excited to talk about it when they feel licensed to.
Why is it that there's a stigma there? Is it that depression, we're understanding this is something physically out of your control, but loneliness
exactly.
We might blame ourselves for?
Exactly. It's like saying, oh, there must be something wrong with me or people don't like me. But what scientists are discovering is that loneliness actually has nothing at all to do with the community that you're a part of. You can have a huge network of support, but if you don't feel like that support is enough for you, you still feel lonely. So it's about the quality that you're getting in your life. You know, you may spend weeks alone and not feel loneliness at all, or you may spend weeks in close proximity to other people and still crave something different. So everyone just has a different threshold.
And you write, and this is an interesting point you made in The Atlantic, that we have this strong, silent type as a role model in American culture, this idea that we're independent. We need our own space in a lot of ways. There's a tension between that as a positive value and it sort of bleeding naturally into loneliness at the same time.
Absolutely. You know, I think also as Midwesterners, I think that's a very Midwestern sensibility to sort of handle things yourself, take care of things on your own. And in a certain way, that's great. I think it's great that we have Americans have this sort of sense of independence, but it comes, I think, sometimes at a cost, too.
Right. Did I hear, Kristen, you're from Wisconsin yourself?
I'm from Green Bay.
Now, do you see different attitudes or feelings about loneliness since you've left the Midwest?
Well, I think every city and every town is so different in the way that we interact with one another in terms of communities. I mean, for me, the loneliest I ever felt was when I lived in a town in which there wasn't a lot of walking. Like, I never would bump into people or run into people because everyone was just always on the interstate, and I missed those sort of happenstance encounters, which certainly now I live in New York, you know, we're always sort of in really close proximity to one another.
Talking to Christine Radke. She's working on an essay collection called Seek You, Essays on American Loneliness. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have thoughts on why we're apparently more and more lonely, if you have a story you'd care to share yourself, we've got Ben on the line with us in Madison. Ben, hi.
Hello. I'd like to add to this. I think one of the causes for loneliness is the smartphone addiction. When everything's at your fingertips, why would you make yourself vulnerable to a stranger, whether that's someone just in small talk or chatting with you about something, or someone is flirting with you and trying to connect with you and get your phone number? I see this perhaps the worst among, I'm not going to pick on millennials, but people more towards their 20s. They're just completely absorbed in their phone, and they wouldn't notice if the building they were in caught fire. If it did, they would probably find out from social media.
Ben, thanks for the call. I want to jump in. Kristen, do you think that our technology is helping us isolate ourselves more? And even though we might feel connected, we're missing something?
I think it really depends on the circumstance. I completely agree that it's now a tool that allows us to stay home or to stay in our spaces. And one of the things that encourages us to go out and do something on a really basic level is sheer boredom. If we're bored, if we have nothing to do, we're more likely to propel ourselves in front of other people. But if we have, you know, endless streaming shows and the internet to entertain us, we might be less willing to put ourselves out there. On the other hand, when you think about older people or people with disabilities or people who are separated through work from their families or something like that, something like a smartphone can be a really helpful tool.
Now, an interesting thing, thanks for that call, Ben, an interesting thing, Kristen, about your piece in The Atlantic and your book, you're writing about loneliness. You're also illustrating about loneliness. So it's a graphic, not novel, graphic nonfiction, I guess you're working on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tell us about the images and how you're trying to capture those stories.
Yeah. So I'm drawing a lot of portraits. I like drawing people. The project actually started in a series for The New Yorker in which I was drawing people alone in public settings because I'm really interested in how in a city as congested as New York, we do still spend a lot of time alone. And I love that juxtaposition of the really hectic, crowded city with an isolated figure in front.
What are you hoping comes out of having these conversations, getting these stories, these essays and illustrations of loneliness?
It's a great question. I don't know. I guess I hope that we can talk about this. I mean, one of the things I find so amazing about loneliness is that it's such a universal feeling. It's something that everyone's felt at some point, and in a way, our desire to connect with one another through those shared feelings of loneliness can be really powerful.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier, as people talked about it, you got the sense that there was a hunger to talk about. Is this something that we should be talking about on talk shows, writing about, talking to our friends about more?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the reasons I think it's become such a problem is because often we don't even know how to articulate it ourselves when we're feeling lonely, and then we don't know how to take the steps to join a community or to feel more connected.
Time for a quick call. Caleb is with us in Westby. Caleb, hi, just a brief moment.
Hey there. I was just going to say that I think maybe a contributing factor to the situation is the perspective that people have on loneliness, or rather on being alone. I was just wondering if maybe some people, when they're alone, find it more rejuvenating and it isn't as negative of an issue as it is for others.
Caleb, thanks for the call. And Kristen, that fits into what you were saying earlier. There may be a difference between being alone and feeling lonely.
Absolutely. Isolation or solitude and loneliness are two totally different things. It's completely true.
All right, Caleb, thanks for the call. And Kristen, thank you so much for joining us today. Welcome back to Wisconsin.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Kristen Radke is the art director and deputy publisher of The Believer. She wrote and illustrated the piece we've been talking about called What's the Loneliest You've Ever Been? That appeared in The Atlantic. And Kristen's working on an essay collection called CQ, Essays on American Loneliness. That's due out in 2020. Still time for you to share your thoughts on loneliness and why it seems to be on the rise in the United States. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Let us know what you think. Midterm elections are still a month away, but the American people have already voted in another key campaign. They have selected the fattest bear at one of our country's national parks. Katmai National Park in southern Alaska held the vote over the last week. They declared it to be Fat Bear Week. They had before and after images of a bunch of the bears living on the Brooks River, and they invited the public to weigh in, I'm not the first to make that joke, on which bear had gained the most weight over the salmon season. They say this is not body shaming. This is good news that these bears are putting on weight. The winner was a bear named 409 Bead Nose. The bears don't get to name themselves, apparently. She apparently packed away the most salmon over the last 6 months. The park's Facebook page explains that brown bears in the region need to eat a year's worth of food in just 6 months. By the way, you can see pictures and videos of the Katmai National Park brown bears. Check out their Facebook page. That's spelled K-A-T-M-A-I. It's been off my radar. I wasn't familiar with that park. You can also check out the bear cam at explore.org/bears. When they have solar power there, that is a live cam. Otherwise, there are highlights of bear cubs frolicking, bears sitting on waterfalls looking for salmon. It's pretty good. I made the case to cancel the show today so I could just watch more bear videos. I was overruled. But maybe after the show, I'll watch some more. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.